inside your radio.
Really? That's the way we start a broadcast like that? I don't think so. Come on.
Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
But saying, it's London, ladies and gentlemen. What can I tell you? And in London, it appears that summer was manufactured by General Motors because it's already been recalled. But we press on like the nails. The new Iraq. Yeah. I'm sure you've heard and seen much of what's been going on this week already, including perhaps you saw Paul Wolfowitz, the wolf on the run again. Somebody let him out. Security on Meet the Press today explaining to David Gregory, without any retort or rebuttal from anybody in the sentient part of the universe, that the problem in Iraq is not just some obscure fight between Shiites and Sunnis. Obscure. No, Mr. Wolfowitz, you're obscure. What's going on in Iraq? Tony Blair, you remember him, has refuted claims that the ongoing crisis there was the result of the U.S.-led invasion, in which he participated wholeheartedly. He said pointing fingers at Western nations for the crisis is, quote, bizarre. He's been in the Middle East long enough to know two meanings of that word. We have to liberate ourselves from the notion that we have caused this. We haven't, said Blair, who's now an envoy to the Middle East. I guess they didn't have enough postage to send him to the moon. He wrote that on his website. Tony Blair has a website, ladies and gentlemen. But we have to liberate ourselves from that notion. That liberation is going to work about as well, Tony, as the other one. And I think it's well known by now in America that Iran has sent 2,000 advanced troops to Iraq over this weekend. Because it was the weekend. What are they going to do with the troops? To help tackle the insurgency or the whatever it is. That's from The Guardian. The Iranian president has said Iran was ready to support Iraq from the mortal threat fast spreading through the country, i.e. Sunnis. If it comes as news to people in Washington that our chosen prime minister, who was just recently reelected by a Democratic vote, so when Lindsey Graham on another yak show says Maliki must go, I guess he doesn't believe in democracy. Anyway, if it comes to news as news to people in Washington, Maliki is Iran's favorite Iraqi prime minister, it won't be news anymore. And, of course, Shiite, can I say that on the radio, volunteers are signing up as well after a call by the Grand Shiite Ayatollah Sistani. And from the McClatchy Washington Bureau, which was as right as anybody was during the run-up to the Iraq War and shortly thereafter in its reporting, the magnitude of the Iraqi crisis has yet to capture the attention of Washington, as fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria tightened their grip. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee met to question the man President Obama has nominated to be the next ambassador to Iraq. Not a single senator asked him about the Iraqi government's apparent loss of control. They also didn't ask questions of the man who sat next to him, the current U.S. ambassador to Iraq. No one pressed for answers about how many U.S. weapons supplied to the Iraqi forces had ended up in insurgents' hands, as Iraqi forces shed their uniforms and fled their posts, or what the fate will be of the U.S. military assistance program to Iraq, on which American taxpayers have already spent $14 billion, or why they thought the American training program for Iraq's military had resulted in such a humiliating rout. Oh, well, General Petraeus can answer that as soon as he surfaces. The House Armed Services Committee also showed a decided lack of interest in Iraq developments. At a day-long hearing, Secretary of Defense Hagel fielded not one question about Iraq. A Senate staffer asked about the omission acknowledged surprise at the lack of curiosity from foreign relations about a country where nearly 4,500 Americans had died. Quote, I think there is a general sense of apathy about Iraq, the staffer explained. Iraq is mostly viewed in terms of other issues, unquote. Well, They pretended to care for a while, didn't they? Isn't that enough? Hello, welcome to the show.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss her each night and day? I know I'm not wrong, because the feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay away. Mr. Moss-covered pines, tall sugar pines, where mocking birds used to sing. And I'd love to see that old lazy Mississippi whirring in the spring. Moonlight on the bayous, Creole tunes fill the air. I dream about magnolias in June, and I'm wishing I was there.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans when that's where you left your heart? And there's one thing more, I miss the one I care for more than I miss New Orleans. Go on, Doc.
I miss
then I miss New Orleans.
From London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol Jr. Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. What do they have in common? They're still in the running for a possible U.S. bid to host the 2024 Summer Olympics. A person briefed on the Olympic Committee's decision-making process told the AP that all four cities are still in consideration. L.A. last hosted the Olympics for the second time in 1984 when it basically saved the Olympic movement by taking the games after they had driven Montreal bankrupt and Moscow had been boycotted. L.A. built almost no new facilities for the 1984 Games. Why? My, how times have changed. There's an arduous and expensive process facing any potential bid city. Over the next 6 months, the USOC will decide whether it even wants to try to host the Olympics. The last two U.S. candidates both suffered humiliating fourth-place finishes. New York in 2012, Chicago in 2016. If the USOC goes ahead with the bid, the U.S. city will find itself in a battle with Paris, Rome, Istanbul, and Doha, Qatar. Meanwhile, the construction of venues for the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics in South Korea has hit a snag. The Ministry of Culture, Sports, and Tourism is considering downscaling or redesigning a speed skating venue and an ice hockey rink that were scheduled to be built in Gangwon Province. The two new Olympic venues were overdesigned, says a ministry official. There's no realistic way to make use of them after the Olympics, and their upkeep would cost a lot of money, so we're looking for appropriate solutions, unquote. I think Sochi is still open. Meanwhile, Dateline Rome, IOC President Thomas Bach offered his encouragement to a possible Rome bid for the 2024 Olympics, saying it would be a very strong contender. Thumb on the scale, babe. Rome hosted the 1960 Games. It pulled out of the bidding for the 2020 Olympics when the Italian government refused to provide financial backing. What are they thinking? Bach says the Olympic Committee is looking at shaking up the bid procedure in the future. We need to change philosophy, he says. In the past, we needed to build many stadiums with huge capacity and with so many technical procedures to respect. At the time, maybe it was right, but it doesn't respond to today's demands. This is the head of the IOC. Avery Brundage is spinning in his rings. We have to think about how the games could enter into the social fabric of the host country. We have to be more flexible and understand how to best manage costs. The Olympics? The green eyeshade Olympics? Changes to the bid process are among the issues being considered as part of Bach's Agenda 2020, his blueprint for the future of the Olympic movement. He also sought to assuage concerns over Rio's delayed preparations for the 2016 Games, saying, "Great progress has been made recently." I sure hope so. The Olympics is a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are still in the missile defense business. The Pentagon's next big step in testing its multi-billion-dollar homeland missile defense system is just more than a week away, according to DefenseTech.org. One of the Boeing-made interceptors will be launched from an... We know why we're here. There's the Boeing commercials. That's right, to build stuff like this. One of the interceptors will be launched from an underground silo at Vandenberg in California in an attempt to strike a dummy missile fired from a Pacific range. Because those dummy missiles can be a serious threat to national security. The exercise is designed to gauge whether the system is capable of knocking out an incoming international intercontinental ballistic missile. Never too late to find out. The agency's director describes it as the agency's highest near-term priority. That is the Missile Defense Agency. An interceptor launched from the same site last July missed its target, the latest in a series of failures dating to 2008. Lawmakers have criticized the military's plans to increase the number of interceptors despite problems with the technology, like, can it hit the thing? Can it hit the thing? The system has hit targets in only 8 of 15 attempts. Hey, 50% in baseball, you're in the hall of the high cost of testing. They don't like that either. It's a $250 million exercise per, and many of the interceptors are not yet operational. But if they're not operational, they can't fail. You see? It's win-win. The last year's test failure, the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle, the EKV to you and me, it destroys a projectile on impact, did not intercept the target because the kill vehicle did not separate from the booster's third stage. The failure investigation is progressing toward a root cause. It's only been a year. The Pentagon's top weapons buyer has blamed the failures in part on a rush to design and field the interceptors without proper testing and system engineering. But it's a hurry. We've got to put the thing on the thing. Pentagon's budget request for the next fiscal year, more than $1 billion for the fleet of 30 rocket-like interceptors in underground silos at Fort Greely, Alaska, and Vandenberg. The funding would be used to expand the fleet of interceptors to 44, and some of them might work. The larger ballistic missile defense system is estimated to cost almost $140 billion. It is the Pentagon's second most expensive acquisition program behind the controversial F-35 fighter jet. But at least, I know it's controversial, but at least that thing flies. I know. It's a high bar. I'll see you at the high bar in a little while, but now, news from outside the bubble. From the Age newspaper in Melbourne, Australia, a government push to allow private health insurers to cover visits to general practitioners would create a U.S.-style two-tier health system and drive up doctors' fees, experts have warned. We're a bad thing. The Sunday Age learned Health Minister Peter Dutton has told senior health sector sources in private meetings he's keen to allow private insurers into GP clinics. Under the existing Medicare system, all Australians can expect similar quality of care when they visit their doctor. Changing this to create two classes of GP patients would revolutionize Australian healthcare and potentially undermine Australia's Medicare system, critics or experts say. It would be a fundamental change in the way that general practice is funded, said Australian Medical Association president. The health program director of the Grattan Institute, a private think tank, said if private insurers were allowed to team up with general practitioner clinics, quote, there'll be an increasing number of GPs charging higher fees, increasing costs, both to consumers and the taxpayer, unquote. It works in the States so very well. And from the Independent on Sunday, for the past decade, billions of dollars in aid poured into one of the world's poorest countries, Afghanistan, providing previously unimaginable opportunities to thousands of Afghan workers. Now, the boom is over. The Afghan economy, which had been expanding by as much as 14% a year, has slumped. The slowdown reflects the declining American spending, as well as apprehension about security. Why would they worry about that? In Iraq, President Obama's announcement that U.S. troops will leave for good by the end of 2016 has only fueled and fanned Afghan concerns. People are worried what will happen in the future. Asked a businessman who has invested $500,000 in two private hospitals in Kabul, I'm also worried what will happen to my investments, he asks. Since 2002, the U.S. Congress has appropriated $103 billion to help Afghanistan rebuild its security forces, government, and economy. During the past 7 years, when the bulk of the money arrived, USAID has accounted for about 75% of Afghanistan's GDP. It ain't heavy. It's Afghanistan. 75% of the GDP. I bet they're grateful. The World Bank is cautiously optimistic that Afghanistan will avoid an economic collapse. It says the country was expected to receive about $8 billion in annual foreign assistance in the coming years. Yeah. Check with Congress in about 2 years, babe. World Bank, babe. But the World Bank says the situation remains tenuous, with projections of a 5% growth rate contingent on security. Well, and the country's ability to control corruption. Well, and tap its rich mineral deposits. Many people fear the government will fail to maintain order. Wealthy Afghans have already started shifting assets abroad. I guess they'll be building a huge skyscraper in London soon to soak up that hot Afghan cash. If this was just peacetime, you would probably have a minor recession, but this is wartime, said Anthony Cordesman, a prominent national security analyst in Washington. People panic. People protect themselves. They get out if they can. You don't lend. You don't invest. You basically wait, he says. The way the investment was made in the country, it was not in an upward, efficient manner, says Mohammed Ismail Rahimi, General Director of Police and Monitoring Evaluation for the Afghanistan National Development Strategy. He noted the country's poverty rate has remained at about 36%. All through the boom. U.S. spending helped to expand a small middle class in cities such as Kabul. According to coalition officials, more than 700 bases, outposts, and checkpoints have been closed or handed over to the Afghan military since October 2011. With each closure, Afghan businessmen say it becomes more difficult to obtain contracts. You could try corruption. Oh! Dateline Washington. That was news from outside the bubble, but we continue with news about Afghanistan. Despite years of effort by Western officials to cut off the Taliban's financial lifelines, the militants are as rich as ever, bringing in so much cash from opium trafficking, as well as illegal mining, extortion rackets, and other ventures, that the money itself appears to be a reason for many insurgents to keep fighting. Afghan and Western officials say the Taliban are believed to have earned record revenues last year by Taliban stock. Afghans are growing more opium poppies than ever. It's threatening to wipe out gains made to help the impoverished country improve health, education, and governance, says the Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. He says the narcotics trade is tainting the financial sector, stoking corruption, helping Taliban insurgents and criminal networks. He says there are already signs that the elements within Afghan security forces, well, we're depending on them to, are making arrangements with rural populations to permit opium poppy growing as a way to build local patronage networks. That's not corrupt, is it? Can somebody check for me on that? We'll get back to you. News of APAC! Ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Let's look at some secret stuff. The National Security Agency recently has used a novel argument for not holding onto information it collects about users' online activity. It's too complex, says the Washington Post. The agency is facing a slew of lawsuits over its surveillance programs. One that predates the Snowden leaks challenges the constitutionality of programs that the suit alleges collect information about Americans' telephone and internet activities. A U.S. district judge reversed his emergency order earlier in the week, barring the government from destroying data that the plaintiffs, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, had asked be preserved for the legal case. The NSA argued that holding onto the data would be too burdensome. The complexity of the NSA systems meant preservation efforts might not work. said MSA's Deputy Director General Richard Leggett. It would have an immediate, specific, and harmful impact on the national security of the United States. So would this, babe. The government's explanation raises more concerns, says the legal director of the EFF, Cindy Cohn. To me, it demonstrates that once the government has custody of this information, even they can't keep track of it anymore, even for purposes of what they don't want to destroy. So the plaintiffs want the government to keep the information to prove that they've been keeping the information that they're supposed to destroy, and the NSA says we can't keep it because we have to destroy it because otherwise it's too burdensome. And this is your brain on the war on drugs. U.S. Law Enforcement Administration, Drug Enforcement Administration investigators have visited the homes and offices of Massachusetts physicians involved with medical marijuana dispensaries and delivered an ultimatum: sever all ties to marijuana companies or relinquish federal licenses to prescribe certain medications. This according to several physicians and their attorneys talking to the Boston Globe. The stark choice is necessary, the doctors said they were told, because of friction between federal law and state law. Isn't federal law enforced by that president that used to smoke marijuana? Yeah. The DEA's action has left some doctors whose livelihoods depend on being able to offer patients pain medications and other drugs for which they need licenses to prescribe with little option but to resign from the marijuana companies, where some had held prominent positions. Here are your options, said one. He was told by a DEA investigator. You either give up your DEA license or you give up your position on the board or you challenge it in court. This is your brain on the war on drugs. And now,
ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try.
Dateline Miami. With dredging set to begin in the port of Miami, researchers are scrambling to salvage a much larger than expected trove of delicate corals that were not in the original marine life rescue plan.
Let us try.
Researchers had to be out of the shipping channel sooner than they expected. A much narrower window than expected for salvaging the coral. They asked for an extension. So far, they've been denied one by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And the Corps plans to kill nearly 16,000 cormorants. They nest in the Columbia River estuary. This would be in an effort to protect threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead. The Corps issued its proposed management plan this week. It would wipe out about half the cormorants currently nesting on an island at the mouth of the Columbia River by 2018. So they'll miss the 2020 Olympics. Officials say it's the best way to reduce the colony to the number of birds required under an agreement that allows the Corps to operate dams on the Columbia River. What do you want, dams or birds? Or fish? Scientists estimate cormorants on this island ate 18 million protected salmon and steelhead last year, and are regularly consuming up to 15% of the population swimming through the Columbia River estuary. The Corps has until 2018 to reduce 14,900 breeding pairs down to less than 5,900 in order to preserve protected fish runs that also suffer impacts from dams. The birds would primarily be killed with shotguns. They would try.
No matter how hard I fight it, oh, I'm still in love. No matter how hard I fight it, oh, I'm still in love with you. Oh. Yes. Yes, you can. When they talk about making love, baby, you're the best. But yes, you are. I don't want to brag about you too much and give others ideas, but I'm trying hard to express myself.
From London, this is Le Show, and now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A newly completed internal audit of security contracts at U.S. embassies abroad, best place to find them, found that none of those examined had fully complied with vetting and other requirements for contractors who provide the first line of defense against attack. The audit by the State Department's Inspector General was conducted in the wake of the Benghazi attacks. Local guards contracted to secure the perimeter and entry to the diplomatic compound there were found to have fled. You know, like Iraqi army troops. What's with... Of six embassies selected for review based on location and terrorism threat level, none fully performed all vetting requirements for local guards, placing embassies and personnel at risk, the Inspector General audit said. Chief diplomatic security officers at five of the six were said to have performed inadequate oversight of local guard vetting. The performance of local security guards was a significant factor raised by the State Department's own accountability review board examination of the Benghazi incident. An investigation of Benghazi by the Senate Intelligence Committee found that U.S. mission had been vandalized and attacked in the months prior to the fatal assault by some of the same guards who were there to protect it. Nutty. Nutty world, isn't it? The eight patrol boats the United States bought for the Afghan police were deemed a top priority to transport government supplies and to deter smuggling and illegal entry into Afghanistan, according to the military. But instead of being shipped to Afghanistan, the boats, which cost more than $3 million, have sat unused in a Virginia warehouse for almost 4 years, according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. There is no apparent use for them, and the Navy is now faced with having to repurpose or sell or junk them. Special Inspector General tried to find out why the boats were purchased and never used. The military has been unable to provide records that would answer the most basic questions surrounding this $3 million purchase, he said. Pervasive corruption deprives Afghanistan of funds sorely needed to rebuild the country after a decade of war and poses the most serious threat to the success of the massive reconstruction effort, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan says. The problem is set to worsen as U.S. troops withdraw and security deteriorates. It's not going to look at the leaving civilians able to travel safely and check on projects only in about 20% of the country by December 2014, and even that may be optimistic, said the inspector general. He painted a picture of ambitious investments thrown into a country on such a massive scale that it has overwhelmed its capacity to cope. U.S. policies bear part of the blame for the crippling levels of graft, he says. The initial U.S. strategy in Afghanistan favored a climate conducive to corruption, beginning by cutting deals with warlords who worked alongside the U.S. as a proxy force to drive the Taliban and al-Qaeda from power. These warlords often used U.S. support to operate with impunity to increase their political power and improve their economic positions, said the inspector general. Afghan political leaders have built allegiances by cutting political deals that put powerful figures in key government positions and allowed them to behave with impunity. Worsening the situation, he says, is that the U.S. has no clearly defined strategy for dealing with the corruption it's helped to embed within the Afghan government. Well, you want us to create it and defeat it? It's asking a lot. Maybe too much? 75% of Nuclear Regulatory Commission employees who participated in an internal survey said they received poor performance reviews after registering formal objections to agency decisions. For employees that object to policy, technical, or administrative statements contained in agency documents, the agency has a formal non-concurrence process meant to ensure the concerns of staffers are heard. But according to a survey conducted by the NRC's Office of Enforcement, many of those surveyed about their own experience submitting formal objections through channels believe there had been negative consequences to doing so. But it's only the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What the heck? News of Inspectors General. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, while the San Antonio Spurs are providing a, to those of us who care, thrilling demonstration of how team basketball is to be played at the highest level, on another level, the saga of the Los Angeles Clippers goes on. Supposedly, there had been a deal made between the owners' estranged wife, Shelley Sterling, and former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, in which the latter would pay $2 billion for the team, co-owned by the former. But Clippers owner Donald Sterling has hired four law firms, to dig up, I thought I had too many lawyers, to dig up embarrassing information about NBA, National Basketball Association executives, and fellow team owners. According to a person familiar with the latest escalation in Sterling's battle to maintain control of the team, this is from James Rainey at the Los Angeles Dog Trainer. Firms hired by Sterling have already found dirt on NBA executives, the confidant says. Racial discrimination by NBA officials, at least allegations of such, that are as bad as comments Sterling made on tape. The league has repeatedly suggested it has done nothing wrong and that Sterling is trying to distract from his own failures. He spread the work out to four law firms instead of just one in an attempt to expand and expedite the reach of the inquiry. Each firm can bill him up to $50,000 to produce results over the next month. He hopes the dirt will cause embarrassment for the NBA and Commissioner Adam Silver, who issued a lifetime ban and $2.5 million fine against the Clipper owner. They're trying to apply a standard, but they're not applying it equally to everyone, including themselves, said Sterling's ally. That is going to create a real legal problem for them. The commissioner says, if Donald chooses to litigate against us, so be it. It's just a question of time. He did not comment on Sterling's latest move. His estranged wife, in the deal to sell the team, has offered to immunize the NBA against any lawsuit. NBA officials say Sterling might be suing himself. I said suing. And James Rainey in the LA Times also reports that despite that eye-popping figure of $2 billion, four times as much as has been paid for a National Basketball Association pro franchise previously, ex-Microsoft executive Steve Ballmer says the outrage about the racist comments that Sterling made on tape with his putative ex-girlfriend. That outrage, according to Ballmer, has made the Clippers quote, a national brand.
Your team was a loser, stinking up the gym. A coach would start winning, you'd get rid of him. Then you got an all-star, fans would come and stay. Folks cared what you say. So your girlfriend taped you. You were anything but bland. Your racist rants went viral. You're a national brand. A national brand. National brand. So says Stephen Ballmer, you're a modern Arnold Palmer, you're a national brand. Your dad was a lawyer, had a famous pal, football star turned actor, liked to wrestle with his gal. Wrestling turned to killing, it was all on live TV. Anyone came near it, got some notoriety. So you and your sisters gave fate a helping hand. Mugging for the cameras, you're a national brand. National brand. So says Stephen Ballmer, you're supposed to make us calmer. You're a national brand. Everyone's a sucker for the next little thing. Get YouTubed up, get tweeted, then you've got that zing. Doesn't really matter if you got a thing to say. People wonder just how you got that way. The more obvious, the better. Build a mountain out of sand. You may be an a-hole, but you're a national brand. National brand. You can even be canned or composed of polymer, but if you ask Steve Ballmer, you're a national brand.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
Save,
cheap, too cheap to meet.
Cheap,
save,
too safe to meet.
Save,
save,
too safe to meet.
Our friend Addie the Atom is with us in the studio. Addie, enjoying the change in temperature?
I just spin faster.
All right. Good advice for all of us, don't you think?
No.
The Nuclear Regulation Authority in Japan has disclosed the results of its research into seabed radioactivity off the leaking Fuk power station. Ocean soil collected about 6 kilometers away from the power plant. How far is that, Addie?
No idea. I'm an atom. What do you want? You want me to be a converter?
No, I want you to be an atom. That soil contains as much as 2,000 becquerels of cesium-137 per kilogram. The half-life of cesium is, Addie?
30 years.
That you know.
I'm an atom.
The nuclear watchdog said it is difficult to assess the figure because there's no standard to compare it with. They'll continue their research. The search for a tritium leak at the Dresden, Illinois generating station entered its third day beginning of this week. Evidence of the leak turned up last Saturday when environmental officials identified tritiated water in one of the Morris, Illinois facility's storage tanks. The contamination was contained to on-site water only.
Excellent,
officials notified regulatory officials of the leak. The station's last tritium leak was way back in 2009.
It's an age.
Tritiated water, drinking it, according to the EPA, could lead to cancer as the radioactive liquid goes directly into soft tissues and organs. It occurs naturally in the environment in very low concentrations, but it's also a byproduct of nuclear reactors. The leak has been contained on site, so the water is safe, says one of the local authorities. He added that employees were not at risk and could safely continue their work. It's right near the Kankakee. It's on the Kankakee River.
Thank you. Didn't know that.
On the Kankakee. So, they did find the cause of the leak. The tank is drained. Officials are still considering how to repair the leak. The leak was found in a storage tank and is no bigger than the end of a pencil.
Pencil can't hurt you.
Apparently not, but the end of the pencil can. Tritium, it's the new black, for real. Because Dateline New York, there's been a spike of radioactive material discovered in groundwater beneath the Indian Point nuclear plant in New York State. The NRC and Entergy, which operates that plant, are trying to locate the source of the tritium.
Have they looked at the pencils?
Two monitoring wells picked up a spike in the levels of the isotope in groundwater and bedrock under the plant in March. The source of the tritium is a bit of a mystery. It could be related to movement of spent fuel. Back in March, the highest level of tritium has dropped substantially, but is still above normal.
That's good, isn't it? Better than normal?
Above is not the same as better. TEPCO said a robot sent inside Unit 1 of the wrecked Fuk plant has discovered the source of water leaks plaguing the decommissioning work. A robot designed by Hitachi GE for the first time took clear pictures showing water drips from the reactor containment vessel into the building's basement via an elastic pipe joint, TEPCO said. The plant operator has struggled to determine how water dumped on the units for cooling is leaking.
Struggle over.
Maybe. The continuing series of workplace safety incidents at Hanford's nuclear reservation, the cleanup there, 6 more workers received medical attention after breathing toxic vapors last week. Unlike every other workplace in Washington state, from the BP oil refinery to corporate offices in downtown Seattle, the Hanford site is exempt from federal and state workplace safety oversight and enforcement.
Well, that's got to lead to more safety, doesn't it? You know, rule of threes?
I guess that's Adam talk. Radioactive chunks of industrial metal that could be used in terrorist attacks are sometimes secured at sites around the country with no more than ordinary padlocks, according to congressional auditors. Also, auditors called ineffective the procedures for doing background checks of employees handling the materials.
They're supposed to be specially something?
Yeah, especially something would be good since they're handling radioactive materials, don't you think?
Hey, I have no special background on me, and I'm radioactive.
A report by the Government Accountability Office found that radiation material, some small enough to fit in a pocket, is often left where doors are unlocked or where skylights allow easy access. Four trucks carrying radioactive material have been stolen since September 2005, in some cases because a driver left the keys in the ignition or the door lock. Nothing, right?
Driver error.
The recent news of a water shortage due to a broken pipeline affecting thousands in strife-ravaged eastern Ukraine spells trouble for the safety of that country's nuclear power plants. That's because the safety and reliability of a country's critical infrastructure, like its electric power and water grid, is essential to safely run nuclear reactors.
Don't put them in countries with unrest. Yeah, why didn't I think of that?
Japan will introduce legislation this year to ratify a controversial treaty backed by General Electric and other nuke plant manufacturers. The treaty seeks protection from damage claims caused by nuclear accidents.
They're supposed to pay for that?
The treaty, known as the Convention on Supplementary Compensation for Nuclear Damage, will encourage experienced U.S. companies to assist in the cleanup and decommissioning at Fuk, said Japan's foreign ministry, talking to Businessweek. Protection from accident claims is needed because of the dangers and risks that remain at Fukushima. The plant has three melted reactors. The important thing is to do everything we can to facilitate the cleanup and decontamination, said U.S. Deputy Energy Secretary Daniel Poneman. The CSC, the treaty, is a means to support U.S. companies in that role.
I guess they need it.
I guess they do. Or at least they want it and say they need it. Clean, cheap, safe, 2 centimeter. Our friend the atom. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the, around this time, the 20th anniversary of a very famous ride along the San Diego Freeway, the 405 in Los Angeles, the celebrated slow speed chase in which O.J. Simpson was riding in a friend's Bronco, his friend Al Cowlings, A.C. When the police were trying to find him, they drove south, I think, toward the Mexican border and then headed back up toward O.J.'s home in Brentwood. And on live television, split screen with the NBA Finals, this slow speed chase played out over hours. That started the whole O.J. trial thing, and it spawned a lot of stuff in the culture and in the business world.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls. And
wow, what was that? Something go wrong in culture and, I say, now we've broken down totally, ladies and gentlemen. In culture, here we are, in culture and in the business world.
Every day, millions of people drive the Southern California freeways, but only a special few can be a part of freeway history. From suburban Orange County to near suburban West Los Angeles, it is a journey more famous than the Lewis and Clark Expedition and the Donner Party combined. As many people saw this rush hour trek across the heart of the LA Basin as saw man's first walk on the moon. And unlike that historic journey, this one you don't have to just dream about taking. Introducing OJ Line Tours, the only guaranteed 1.7 times actual speed tours of the nationally televised OJ Simpson slow speed chase. You've seen it from helicopters and through the rear view mirrors of other vehicles. Imagine being able to see OJ Simpson's most famous ride from his point of view. This 2-hour fully escorted tour along the 91 and 405 freeways, as well as world famous Sunset Boulevard, will be the experience you'll want to never forget. You'll ride in air-conditioned comfort on a specially rented bus. Out of respect for the victims of the tragedy, you'll not be allowed to use flash photography. But if you order tickets before this offer expires, you'll be able to purchase limited edition posters, t-shirts, caps, coasters, towels, and toasters, with many of the landmarks along the route, such as the Mattel Toy Factory and the Herbalife Building, illustrated in full 2 colors. Bring your kids. It's a gift that's sure to last through at least 2 grades of school. OJ Lines guarantees you will ride exactly the same route as OJ did. And frequent Go Juice Go pep rallies with your fellow passengers will bring back all the excitement of that that special Friday afternoon. On your next trip to Southern California, tell your travel agent that you want to be a part of history. You want to ride OJ Line Tours. Seats are limited, must be over 18. Length of trip approximate.
Now, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week. The show written and performed by yours truly, Harry Shearer. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. The USN 440 cable system in Japan. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, 7.490 megahertz shortwave. On the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCSN.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast from WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes. Maybe just like that little operator error never having happened. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson, the WWNO in New Orleans, and Bodders, Adrian Bodnum, here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, the playlist of the music heard here on, and Cars I Talk t-shirts, there still are a few, at harryshearer.com. And me? Yeah, I'm still on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. Our fine affiliates stream this program throughout the day on Sunday, and you can find those streams at publicradiofan.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship network, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. It's just talking that's hard. So long from London.